Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is United States v. Ojomo. Mr. Phillips.
May it please the court. My name is John Phillips, and I represent Olusegun Ojomo on appeal. In Mr. Ojomo's appeal, we made three distinct claims, one challenging the admission of certain evidence at trial, and two related to sentencing. If I may, Your Honor, I'd like to address the second claim first, the erroneous inclusion of the Mollo and Ferenczi frauds at sentencing. At sentencing, the district court included the Mollo and Ferenczi frauds when calculating the amount of money involved in the fraud. The inclusion of these frauds pushed the amount above $200,000 and increased Ojomo's sentencing level from 7 to 8. We challenge the inclusion of these frauds because the district court failed to explicitly state and support its reasons for including them. This requirement has been enforced most recently by this court in United States v. Smith, and previously by this court in the Duarte, Feller, and Crockett cases. Additionally, we challenge the inclusion because the district court failed to give the evidence proffered by the government the, quote, searching inquiry, end quote, that this court requires when deciding whether those allegations, the inclusion of the Mollo and Ferenczi frauds, were relevant conduct.
Didn't we say in U.S. v. Smith that the evidence may be, or the findings may be bare bones, and the paucity of explicit findings does not mandate vacation of the sentence? That was in Smith as well, wasn't it?
Yes, you did, Your Honor. However, you said that the findings were bare bones in that case, and that you'd hope that the district court would do more. But that if the district, but if there were findings that could support the inclusion of the frauds, then the court would look to those. as well.
And we did affirm the sentence in that case, didn't we?
Yes, Your Honor, as you did in the Crockett case as well. In this case, there's good reason for the court to be suspicious of the government's inclusion of the Mullen Ferengi frauds. Despite the fact that the frauds occurred 17 months before Jomer's arrest, 2 years before his trial, 9 months, and the government found evidence of the frauds 9 months before his trial, they're not introduced until the final days before the sentencing hearing. They're not mentioned in the evidence presented at trial. They did not appear in previous versions of the sentencing hearing. In fact, the government did not introduce them until it offered objections in the additional addendum or the supplemental addendum to the pre-sentence report, after the pre-sentence report had shown that the government had only proved up $196,000 of fraud, $4,000 short of the $200,000 cutoff.
Counsel, what case law are you referring to in the Smith case?
United States v. Smith.
What case law in the case?
Where the court says that the district...
quote it, will you?
Certainly. In Smith, the court says that where the district court is considering whether conduct is relevant conduct as part of the same course of conduct, that it must explicitly state and support its reasons for including that conduct.
Where does it say that? Just quote it. Quote it.
The quote is explicitly stated in support, Your Honor, and I may refer to my brief quickly. I should give you
I just want the exact language that you're referring to, because I don't see.
Your Honor, I'll have to get back to you on the quote exactly.
I think you will, because I don't think you're going to find it. But I just want to read something to you. A finding that uncharged activity is relevant conduct that can be considered under the sentencing guidelines is a finding of fact that we will not disturb unless clearly erroneous.
Yes, sir. But when the district court is making a finding of fact, I believe...
And it goes on in Smith and says, and applying these standards to the correctly applied sentencing guideline to findings of fact that were not clearly erroneous, we thus affirm Smith's sentence.
Yes, sir. But in Smith, there's a second problem, too, that the defendant raised, which is that the district court didn't make... There are two findings. First, he challenged the sufficiency of the evidence, including his crime. And second, he challenged the fact that the district court didn't make findings explicit enough that they're involved in the same course of conduct, these outside instances that weren't involved in trial. And there,
in light of that dicta that you're allegedly referring to, the court did affirm the conviction because it was not clearly erroneous.
Yes, well, maybe, Your Honor, a better case for our side is in the Beller case or the Duarte case, where the court remanded for resentencing, where the district court failed to make...
Now, what do you say that those cases say?
Those cases, it was applying the same...
Can you quote that case law so that we're not taking it out of context?
I don't have the precise language of the cases, but the court remanded in both those cases for resentencing, where the district court did not make explicit statements of finding, and the court said that the district court...
There's no doubt it would be helpful if we did, but there is no such law that you're saying is in there.
Ms. Phillips, if we agree with you that there could have been at least better articulation, and in your case you would suggest insufficient, but could we look to the pre-sentence report to find... enough to buttress the ultimate finding by the district court as to the uncharged crimes?
Well, Your Honor, in past cases, this court has looked to fact other than those cited by the district court, so I believe you could.
So I just wonder whether that's a more fulsome explanation or can add the kind of weight that might be necessary in this case. Would you still think that this pre-sentence report is one that cannot do that?
Well, the pre-sentence report provides several facts about the applications. For instance, that in Ferengi fraud, I believe it says that the same employer was used.
Right.
Outside of that, it says that the frauds occurred in a Terre Haute neighborhood and occurred over the 2-year period, citing Mr. Adjomo's indictment.
Mm-hmm.
there appeared to be, Your Honor, a neighborhood of fraud going on in this area, including fraud involving people with whom Mr. Adomo knew. Mm-hmm. And you know, the only evidence directly connecting these frauds to Mr. Adomo, introduced by the government, was that the names of Mallo and Ferenczi were handwritten on a piece of paper found in his apartment. Inspector Sheehan, in his testimony at the sentencing trial, said that he believed that these names were widely available in the fraudulent community. So what we argue is that even if the district court could have done more, we're not sure in this case that it's possible, because these names were widely available in the fraudulent community, and the only other evidence is that similar frauds occurred in the Terre Haute area in the two-year period. If I could move to my first one.
Surely.
Holzhagen Adomo was charged with commission of a scheme of fraud. And to prove the scheme, the government introduced a lot of evidence related to the scheme, but introduced three sets of evidence that we challenge here today involving a Nifa Washe / Muhammad Ali identifier, a Hornickel identifier or set of identifiers, and identifiers involving Michael Smith. I'd like to begin with the Nifa Washe Ali identifiers. These didn't have they were found in Mr. Adomo's apartment, but didn't have his picture on them, were not related to any fraudulent conduct he had introduced. We feel that this was an evidence of piling on, and also evidence that perhaps he had unsavory friends of other bad acts or conduct, but not related to, or not relevant to, the scheme of fraud of which he was accused, that they are wrongfully admitted. Second, in the district court, when admitting these, the second, you know, I think we should consider the Hornickel and Smith identifiers together. The district court, when admitting these, applied Rule 403, which applies to just the general evidentiary rule for prejudicial effect. We feel this is the wrong evidentiary rule to apply. The district court should have applied Rule 404B for evidence of other bad acts. Neither the Hornickel identifier nor the Smith identifier were used in frauds themselves. They were found on Adomo's person in his apartment, but they're not part of the scheme of fraud, which is a narrow scope that the government sought to prove. At trial, in its opening and closing statement, it set out that it was to prove four frauds involving Thaler, Layton, Faith, and Young. These frauds are out.
The collection of those matters relate to a fraudulent effort on his behalf.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Couldn't the collection of those items, the other items that you seek to have excluded, make a showing that there was a fraudulent scheme involved? In general.
In general, Your Honor, I think they're false identifiers. There's no connection of those identifiers to fraud. Perhaps an inference could be drawn, but I think to introduce the evidence, especially at trial, the government has to connect those identifiers to an actual scheme, to fraudulent intent. I think it failed to do so in this case when introduced.
Would you think it's similar to a gun found in a drug dealer's home as evidence of criminal activity?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the gun is a tool
of
the trade. And here the false identity was as well. I think it would depend in that case on the indictment and how specific it was in setting out its fraud. Now, it's true the third paragraph in the indictment does say the use of false identifiers, but it says the use of false identifiers for the purpose of the commission of fraud. We think that that's a limitation on the third paragraph and on the evidence that could properly come in.
What if he'd been a forger and there were a lot of other forgers where he's practicing, but they weren't actually used in the offense? The ones that were used in the forgery were other specific exhibits, but you had a whole series of other where he was practicing. You think those would be admissible?
Yes, Your Honor, I do think those would be admissible.
And there's some similarity in that idea in the false identifiers?
Well, there is. I think that a line can be drawn, though, between the forgery and the false identifiers. The false identifiers are not necessarily connected to fraud, and they're, you know, while one, it's difficult to imagine a good reason one might have, there are a lot of harmless reasons one might have false identifiers. For forgery, I think, is a more difficult case. You know, our final argument is the challenge of the sentence and the inclusion of additional conduct under Apprendi against New Jersey. Now, at the outset, we understand that the circuit has rejected a challenge of the sentencing guidelines, as many times over rejected a challenge of the sentencing guidelines under Apprendi. However, we think, I should probably save the remainder, but we would ask the circuit to reconsider. I'd like to save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Very, very good. Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Mr. Ong?
Thank you, Your Honors. Winfield Ong for the United States. To just briefly address first the sentencing issue, I think it's important to understand, as the government points out in its brief, the context in which the sentencing hearing took place. None of the facts that appear in the supplemental addendum to the pre-sentence report or that were argued by the government in its sentencing memorandum or that were produced by the government at the hearing that tied Ajomo or tied those Molo and Ferenczi frauds to the frauds that Ajomo had already been convicted of were in dispute. The record shows that the Ajomo at sentencing did not contest any of those facts that were in evidence. What he did was simply say, it wasn't me. And in that context, the judge's findings were more than adequate. He simply said, this is like a fingerprint. The facts that had been produced that tie this to Ajomo were really overwhelming, and again, undisputed, and said these are like a fingerprint of Ajomo based on the facts that already proved at trial that the judge, of course, heard. And in that context, there was really nothing more to say. Ajomo didn't really produce any argument other than at the sentencing, other than simply say, it just wasn't me. And in that respect, it's important, I think, to see at the sentencing hearing where it became completely explicit, as it really was at the trial, that Ajomo's whole defense was lots of people had access to my apartment, in particular this person named Anafuoshi, and they're the ones who did it. And in that context, I think as well, Ajomo's argument is really shown to be the box, trying to box the government in, that it really is, in that on the one hand, they want to exclude evidence of sentencing, for example, that ties Ajomo into this fraud, but then on the other hand says we can't introduce evidence at trial that tied Ajomo into the apartment where this took place. This is not what relevant evidence is about. The government is entitled to prove the background of the scheme to defraud. It's entitled to try and preclude questions that jurors might have as the evidence comes along. And in this case, it offered evidence, and the district court found it was highly relevant of a scheme to defraud that tied Ajomo directly into this apartment where the scheme was obviously taking place. In the context, as appellant's counsel has argued, that somehow there were other people, again, that had access to the apartment, someone else might have done this, that evidence becomes even more relevant. It only highlights how important it was for the government at trial to tie Ajomo directly into this apartment and into the scheme to defraud that was evidenced by items found during the search warrant. In that context, again, the whole scheme to defraud was broad, as the court pointed out, alleged in the indictment. It was involving, in one complete short paragraph, acquiring identifiers, false identifiers. That's what was produced at trial. It was relevant to that specific allegation in the indictment, and it simply wasn't unfair prejudice, which in the end I think is what the appellant's argument really boils down to, is not that this material wasn't relevant. It just doesn't seem plausible to argue that, but that somehow it was really unfair and shouldn't have been let in. The government bears a high burden at trial, as the jury is repeatedly reminded in pretrial instructions and post-trial instructions. Purely the government's burden, beyond a reasonable doubt, the defendant has no burden, and the government simply can't, what I suggest is really tying one hand behind its back based on the appellant's argument of relevant evidence. That's all the government has, unless there are any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Mr. Phillips?
Member Bellew, Your Honor, I'd just like to respond to the judge's question about the language in the Smith case. The court wrote on page 783 of the Smith case, because the relevant conduct rule is, quote, not without limits, and because its application so favors the government, we insist that courts be scrupulous to ensure the government is adhered to those limits. One of the ways we ensure that these limits are maintained is by requiring sentencing courts to, quote, explicitly state and support, either at the sentencing hearing or in a written statement of reasons, the finding that the unconvicted activities bore the necessary relation to the convicted offense. Your Honor, we would only offer that if this requirement is not enforced, the district court doesn't, and the court will consider any error by the district court harmless, this requirement would simply be eviscerated. We ask that the court enforce it here. We'd like to rest on a brief. Thank you.
All right, thanks to all counsel. And Mr. Phillips, to you and the program at the law school, a special thanks for accepting this appointment and ably representing the petitioner on appeal. Case is taken under advisement.